Hi, you're listening to Branded Search and Beyond with Jason Barnard, the Brand SERP guy and CEO of CaliCube. In each episode, we'll introduce you to experts and thought leaders who will share their insights and strategies to help you build a strong and memorable brand in the digital landscape. If you're worried about the future of SEO strategy because of ChatGPT and Google Gemini, we got you covered. Go to CaliCube.com to find out more about the future-proof digital marketing strategy. Now, buckle up and get ready to learn from industry experts here on Branded Search and Beyond with Jason Barnard.
Welcome, David. Thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for inviting me, Jason. Great to be on.
Brilliant. And David has the responsibility towards the entire community and you, the audience, that he was the one who encouraged me to sing this song live. If he hadn't supported me and said, yeah, do it, Jace,
I never would have started
singing. Oh, crumbs. Too late.
No.
Quick hello, and we're good to go. Welcome to the show, David Bain.
Well, thank you, Jason Barnard. It's a pleasure to be here.
Ooh, and he's got a bit of a tune in him as well. David, wonderful singer. Lovely to see you here. Today, we're going to be talking about crafty content creation. I love the word crafty. It all sounds very London, but you're from Scotland, aren't you?
Yeah, I get the C's in there, absolutely. I seem to be navigating towards C brands at the moment for some reason.
C brands as in the open sea.
C brands as in casting cred, crafty content creation has to have a C in it.
Right, brilliant. Well, talking of which, we're going to look at the brand cert. We're not going to look at yours. We're going to look at the brand cert for casting cred. There you go. That's pretty good. We've got some delightful site links there. We've got the Twitter. And over on the right, see results about Casting Cred Limited. Your company has a knowledge panel. And if you click on that, we go to the next screen. And we see the delightful knowledge panel founded in 2006. I actually checked, it is the correct company. That is your company. So you now, or your company at least, has a knowledge panel, which is amazing and wonderful. And you see at the bottom there, you can claim it. So if you click on the next screen, you can see that you can claim it with your own sites. I checked, those are your sites. There are 26 weeks to do something. Don't know what the thing is, but that's half a year, isn't it? That's brilliant. Took me a while to figure that one out as well.
Yes. Wow. So I didn't even realize that that existed. I haven't spent any time, I'm afraid, on knowledge panels.
I spend my entire life doing it. So I find stuff like this all the time and then realize that nobody else cares.
Well, I was wanting to ideally rank for my name or have a knowledge panel for my name at some point. Unfortunately, there's a notorious David Bain that exists. And I've also registered. I finally got davidbain.com. It took me about 15 years to get it. Wow. So I've got to do something with that. So perhaps that could enable me to do a bit of ranking.
Might help a bit, yeah. But how did you get it? Did somebody just forget about it? Another David Bain, I would assume.
It was just tracking. I ended up getting it through Google GoDaddy Auctions and then seeing that it was available and then ending up having to bid for it. Just cost me a couple of $100 or so. So it wasn't too bad considering it's something that I really wanted to get.
Well, I was going to say with a name like yours, which is quite, I was going to say common, but that sounds rude, but I can't think of another word for it. Presumably the bidding was quite excited because there'll be 10,000 David Baines, whereas with Jason
there
Barner,
were a few. There were a few. Yeah, I reached out to someone a long time ago that obviously wasn't using it and had some kind of a holding page on there, and he basically said, "No, I might use it at some point." So he didn't want to sell it, and he's obviously let it go at some point. And thankfully, I was tracking or looking at the time.
Right. Yeah. I actually did the same thing, but 15 years ago, somebody else had jasonbarnard.com and I managed to get hold of it because they forgot about it, presumably. And I had the surprises. My email was jason@jasonbarnard.com. And of course, he'd used the same email. So I logged into Vistaprint and saw his entire order history. It was really weird. Goodness. And then you realize how important it is not to lose a domain name if you're using the emails, because you lose control of the accounts. Yeah. And other people can log into your accounts if they happen to use the same initial part of their email address. So there's a lesson to be learned. But that's not the point today. The point today is crafty content creation.
Yeah, and just I mean, slightly in relation to content and that conversation, I remember letting a domain name go because I was just fed up of the site. And the site used to do quite well for me. It was a long time ago, so I used to do things like selling links on there and getting an income through that. But anyway, I let the site go, and then the whole website was down and didn't exist. But whoever ended up jumping on the domain name went into archive.org, nicked my content from a few years previous, and put it on there. And I thought, that's not on, that's not fair, but I couldn't really do anything about it.
No, but that is crafty, definitely crafty. Yeah, and Anton's cottoned on to the selling links. I was going to try to
smooth over that
and not talk about it. But yeah,
it was so acceptable. It was acceptable 12, 15 years ago.
Right, yeah, when we were both young.
Exactly, exactly. Brilliant. When we were five.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Thank you, thank you, thank you. Right, brilliant. Let's get on to crafty content creation, because I'm actually quite curious by what you mean, because, and the word like crafty is immediately kind of saying, the example you just gave, that for me is crafty. Mm. It's crafty and maybe sneaky. And you're talking about crafty, which is kind of more positive, I would hope.
I was thinking crafty as in good planning. I think too many people don't really plan all the possible mediums when they consider content.
Right.
It's easy to create a wonderful piece of content either in written form or video form or audio form or just for one particular medium. But I don't think enough people think, okay, this is the natural style of content that I need to produce for this particular medium. So I need to ensure that whatever I'm producing caters towards that preferred style, towards the preferred style of the average consumer in that particular platform. And if you really plan out what you're doing beforehand, then you can incorporate things that, if you're producing audio, video, and written form, for example, you can probably incorporate more things that appeal to a YouTube audience or an audio-only audience, or great questions that you can perhaps break down and use as social media. But if you don't really plan that beforehand, then I think too many people are just thinking, okay, that's that piece of content done. Right, let's split it up and send it as many places as we can. But it's not natively produced for the different platforms.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things there. Number one of which is, like most people, I don't really plan, I just do it. And that means that I then have these chunks. So as you're saying, breaking it into chunks becomes very difficult because the chunks don't stand alone. So you can actually chunk your content. I mean, I use video a lot, and I start with video and then think, how can I chunk that? And then how can I make an article out of it? Is that basically your approach, or do you change your approach?
Yeah, I mean, I love starting with video as well, but considering audio at the same time, and I've got a decent audio setup, the audio's got to be great to the average audio listener, because there's a lot of podcasts nowadays. There's something like 2 million podcasts nowadays.
Right.
So producing audio, for example, 10 years ago, you could just get away with anything. But nowadays, it has to be decent quality. So at the same time as you're producing video, as you're interviewing a guest, the guest has got to have decent quality audio. You've got to be recording on separate tracks. You've got to be editing afterwards. And then for video form, does it have to be a certain length? What's the style of the production you're producing? Is there different bumper sections that you can introduce to your video, for example? You know, I've got sections
secret
like this
software
that I thought I'd just throw up there. So that's a bumper that I have on my podcast that I produce, but it comes up in video form as well. So it's a little bit more appealing to the YouTube audience at the same time.
Right, and you've got special software for the bumper software, whatever it said, I can't remember.
Yeah. So I've got lots of hardware and software. I love playing with different things. Shall I just talk to you through my kit briefly?
That's kind of, before we do that, one thing I was saying is some people think to actually be able to do video, I need enormous amounts of kit. That isn't true. So can we start off by reassuring people that you don't necessarily need loads of kit? Then you can show off your kit.
Yeah, okay. I'll do that in one way. What I'll do is I'll show you quickly what I recommend to start off with audio-wise. And then hopefully it'll show people that actually it doesn't sound too bad. So this is my regular setup. And this is fairly expensive in terms of pieces of kit. I've probably got about £1,500 worth of hardware in front of me here to produce this audio. But let me turn my microphone off and this one on. So I'll be one second.
Right. And while you're doing that, I will fill in with some interesting facts about the world. Off you
okay.
go.
Can you hear me now? Hopefully yes. You can hear me now. Okay, so this is me talking through another microphone called the Samson QTU. And this is a USB microphone. So all you do is plug and play it directly into your computer. Ideally, you'll be using a boom arm and a windshield. So it won't sound pristine at the moment, but hopefully it sounds okay, acceptable. And
yeah, I mean,
this microphone...
For a neophyte, somebody who isn't terribly experienced with it, it doesn't sound sufficiently less good than the other one for me to have worried about it.
Exactly. So this one's about £60. Yeah. And that's what I really recommend to begin with. It's a dynamic microphone, which means it's got a small sweet spot in the front. You have to be really good with the positioning of it, which has to be roughly 4 to 6 inches away from you at an angle. Don't speak directly into it. Use that boom arm, use the windshield, which I'm not using. But if you do that, that's where you get started. So that's just to your point that you don't have to spend too much getting started. Let me just turn this one off.
Right, and while you're doing that, I'll say I'm using this, and it's a Lavalier microphone. And that works really well. And the reason I like this, it costs about 30 or 40 euros for this particular one. And the reason I like it is because I don't have to think about all the things you just mentioned. I just clip it onto my shirt. And the sound is probably not as good as the stuff you're getting, but it puts me at ease. And I think part of this is the performance. So being at ease is incredibly important.
And that's why you're a video first guy. You just want to be comfortable with what you're doing and just not think too much about audio. And I completely understand that. And it's a decent sound. You know, you can probably look into it and say there's a small amount of room echo.
Yeah.
And the negative thing about that microphone as well is it lets in a few other sounds from outside. So if there's a big lorry goes past your, there's a dishwasher going off next door, or whatever environment you happen to be in, you probably have to be a little bit careful that there's not so much background noise. If you have a dynamic microphone, you're less likely to suffer from those sort of things.
Right. Yeah, but I mean, it's all a question of balance and kind of making sure you've got the equipment. I think that suits you. I mean, you've got your setup. I like having a microphone here, but I prefer having it like this because then I forget about the microphone and enjoy the conversation with you, David.
Understood.
Right. So
I'm not going to persuade you.
You can start off with a cheap mic, 60 euros.
£60. Yeah, that's a microphone I reckon to begin with. I mean, I produce podcasts for different clients and certainly when it's audio only, you know, it's important to focus on the audio and that's the one that I recommend to begin with. You can get started with a Logitech C920. Webcam and that produces 1080p video, decent quality video, and if you've got reasonable lighting, that's a wonderful way to start off, and that's probably similar kind of price as well.
So you don't need massive amount of equipment, and you can also do it with your phone. Anders Hjort did a conversation interview with me in Budapest and it was kind of fun. We were using kind of portable cameras, whatever they're called. It was great. But so you can start off with something relatively inexpensive as long as it suits your audience and make sure you focus on the great quality sound. But then if you grow up to be a professional like yourself, David, you have the real kit. God, tell us.
Okay, I wouldn't claim to be grown up, but so this microphone is called a Shure Super 55. It's actually not the best microphone that I've got technically. I've got an RE20 microphone, which is a higher cost, more common studio microphone, but I love the look of this one. The only issue with this one is you have to be absolutely spot on with using it. You have to completely talk past it. You can't be too far away from it, otherwise you're really going to drop off. And if I talk into it and go penguins, then you can really hear plosives there, which are not nice noises. So if you're not comfortable using microphones, it's not an ideal microphone to use. But that's what I like using, because I've changed the sound of it slightly by using the hardware in front of me, which is an Art voice channel. Through the Art voice channel, I bring in a compressor, an expander, a high EQ, drop down mid levels. I'm getting technical on you here, but I'm going to carry on. From the Art voice channel, I go into a Rodecaster, and through an XLR cable to the Rodecaster, I use a 75 hertz high pass, a noise gate, a DS or a compressor, and a bit more EQ. So there's a lot going on there with the audio, but I'm happy with it. Well, I'm happy with it at the moment. I'll probably listen to it in a month's time and think I can do better than that. I don't particularly like that, and tweak it a bit more.
But I mean, you've gone through lots of processes there, and it basically says David Bain thinks sound is the single most important thing.
I wouldn't necessarily say it's the single most important thing, but I would say it's the area to start off with. You know, I wrote a blog post a year ago or so called Six Steps from Starting a Podcast to Publishing a Book. And I recommend that people get started off with an audio-only podcast. And if they're not looking at the video camera, if they're not thinking about how things are written or planning things in visual form, then it means that they can just focus on audio quality. And it's probably a good thing that they can focus on audio quality to begin with, because if you start turning on the camera, the most important thing they'll be looking at is how they look and how they come across. And then they'll kind of forget about audio. So I think audio has got to be natural to people before they move on to video, ideally.
Yeah, we had a conversation about that in a London park, the six steps that we actually released. Yeah. It had some pretty funny moments that we released as funny moments.
And quite a few outtakes.
Yeah. We kept getting thrown out by the security people. But anyway, that's another story. So kind of the question here is less that now and moving forward into the crafty content creation, which is what you're saying is plan. It's saying make sure that you can chunk your content. Make sure it's got those standalone chunks. Is that correct? Because I never do that.
Yeah, absolutely. So essentially, it's two things. It's thinking about the medium beforehand and all the different mediums that the content is going to be on.
For the mediums, can you just give me a quick list of all the ones you can think of?
Yeah, sure. An example, three quick examples would be a podcast audio form, YouTube video form, or a book, a physical copy book. Now, not many digital marketers think of a physical copy book, but that can be a wonderful way of building awareness for your brand. And I could keep on listing different forms, blog post form, social media post form as well. And it's nice to build that into it. And you can do that, for example, by having different sections in your show or whatever you're producing that's with social media posts in mind. And then you can perhaps create native videos for a platform like LinkedIn and create captions for that and maybe make the video a little bit more fancy. And it doesn't take a whole lot of additional effort as long as if you've planned that in beforehand. Right, so that's thinking about the mediums beforehand.
Yeah, and you've done that a couple of times, is create a series of videos with different invitees to create then a book afterwards. I remember running back to my house very late to leap on a call on Facebook. I think it was streaming to Facebook. And that was incredible planning. That took absolutely ages for you to plan because you had to plan the entire event and then rewrite the whole content. That's a phenomenal amount of work.
Yeah, it was to a certain degree, it was a learning process, and I didn't know that six-step process. I know we're not focusing in on that, but I didn't know that beforehand. That was looking back in it. That's probably what I'd advise someone else to do based upon the learnings that I had. And I wasn't experienced or best at it when I did it initially, but looking back on it, I can see more of a process now as well. And I'm starting to do that kind of process for clients as well. And it's easier for me to do now because I'm able to systemize it and think, okay, I know precisely what the end product is likely to look like. So what I need to produce to satisfy the needs of all mediums.
Right. Yeah. Okay. So it's having a global view and saying all these pieces fit together to end up with this one final piece on different media. Excuse me. I do apologize. Okay. And then that also comes back. You said you actually become incredibly efficient. How much does that count in your kind of process?
I'm actually finally starting to outsource as well, which is good. And to be great at outsourcing, great at being efficient, you have to know what the system is, how to do it yourself to begin with. So because I've broken the system down, I'm able to do things like, okay, produce the transcripts, turn the transcript into something that's readable. Because, of course, you can't just offer a book as a transcript. A book has to be looking as if it was actually written for that purpose again. Too many people are a little bit lazy and just don't spend any money on turning a transcript into something as if it had been written particularly for that written form. So I outsource that aspect of it, partly because it takes a long time and partly because that's not my favourite medium. I don't absolutely love doing that. No. So I outsource someone to do that. And it's recognizing within that system the opportunities to outsource and further systemize precisely what you're doing.
But I mean, you actually did write a book first, so you knew how it would go. And then you could then explain to the outsourcing person, the freelancer, this is what I'm looking for, and this is the best way to go about it for this particular project. Is that fair?
Exactly. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Because I mean, if you just say to the freelancer, here you go, off you go, they're A, going to waste a lot of time, and B, probably not do it the way you were expecting or you were hoping.
Yeah, exactly. And if you're wanting to be doing this on a budget, then you can't afford to be paying someone $100 an hour, for example. If you want to pay that kind of level, then you can expect someone to be able to take the time to understand the project themselves and just do whatever is necessary. But if you want to pay at the lower end but still have the higher quality output, then you really need to break down precisely what you're looking to do. And you can still achieve that high quality output, but only if you systematize everything.
Right. And that goes for the writing, it goes for the video editing too for you and the sound, or would you not ever let anyone touch your sound?
No, I would do, and I'm intending on doing that. So far, I've used a limited amount of outsourcing for video and for audio. I've used it a bit, but yeah, I kind of like it, but I'm I guess yet to do that kind of area. But the first area to outsource was the area that maybe I struggled with or didn't enjoy quite so much.
Right. So kind of when you're working with clients, I mean, I know you're working on a lot of projects, is you set out to them, here's what we're going to create, here's where how we're going to build the whole thing, and we're going to create whatever it's going to be, video, then clips, and then audio, and then a book or multiple articles. You actually set it out for them?
In general, clients are just just wanting to receive the great final quality products. If they wanted to get involved that closely in it, then they'd probably be more interested in doing it themselves. So if you're producing a podcast, a video series, and a book for someone, generally they want to see a great quality version for each of those three options. Sure, they may be interested in using content in different ways as well, but they're unlikely to want to be involved in doing things like booking contributors or editing all the content. Certainly, in my experience, some clients might be, but I don't believe that most would be.
Right? Yeah, and from a pricing perspective, sorry, I'm now very curious about this. Is it the case that you say, right, we're going to make a video, it costs, like, say, 50, whatever numbers we're talking about, whatever scale we're talking about. If you want to add a book, it's going to be an extra 20. But if you were writing just the book, it would be 40. So you can actually get that economy of scale as you scale it out to different media.
I think you get the economy of scale by producing different types of content at the same time. So it wouldn't be a lot cheaper by just producing the book, certainly in the form that I'm producing it in, because I'm interviewing, current project that I'm doing, I've interviewed 66 different SEO experts. Now, I'm doing that for the book, I'm doing it for the video series and for the podcast, but obviously I'm recording them at the same time. So it doesn't take a whole lot of additional effort. You just have to understand beforehand what you're trying to achieve in the book, and how many people that you require for the whole series, and what you need to structure the podcast and videos to be an enjoyable thing to listen to or to watch for the viewer afterwards.
But 66 is massively optimistic ambitious.
A bit ridiculous, yeah.
Why did you go so big? I mean, couldn't you have just done it with like 30 and then had 30, or did you just want to do something
rash? I overshot, basically. The intention was to do 50 to begin with.
Right.
And then you have a few more and you end up with the number that you end up. But the worst thing that you can end up with is not enough people and scrambling at the last minute to try and get everyone together. It depends on how close your relationships are with people. Generally, I've got quite good relationships with quite a few people in the SEO community, so I can reach out with people, and I'm relatively confident that that half of the people that I reach out to will actually participate in a project. Right. But if I'm thinking about working in an industry that I don't have any experience in, I don't have many contacts in, it may be a much lower percentage.
Right. And that's another question. I mean, if you get somebody coming to you to say, right, I need a set of content for something you know nothing about, how would you approach that? I mean, it's incredibly difficult if they're talking to you about, I don't know, hand sanitizer manufacturing.
Yeah.
Topical.
I would have to work more closely with the client for that, certainly. I'd have to understand the industry a bit. I mean, to a certain degree, I've had a bit of experience in creating content for industries that I know nothing about, because I used to work for a big training business, and I produced digital marketing training programs, but for different industries, so industries I knew nothing about. So I had to apply them to those industries and make sure case studies are accurate as well. So you can apply training and content production principles to industries that you don't necessarily know much about if you speak to enough subject matter experts for that particular industry and do your research and know what you're trying to achieve at the end. So it's possible, but it's going to take more effort to do that.
Right. Okay. So we've got this process where we've got potentially multiple different types of media. Dig down into the craftiness of it. I mean, what are the really good tips and tricks that we're all missing? I mean, I produce loads of video, and I'm sure I'm missing boatloads of great tips and tricks and crafty, creative content. I'm trying to think of a C word, but I can't.
So look, I said there were two main areas of focus that I had. One is ensuring that the content was as appropriate as possible for each medium.
Right.
And secondly, you had to question whether the content was appropriate for the stage of the customer buying cycle that you were trying to target.
Ooh,
so
right, yeah.
I've actually got a couple of slides here. Now, this isn't going to be very good for your audio listeners. No, but
we've done it before. We did it with Nick Ranger, and we just described the slides, and it was great. It was actually pretty cool.
Okay, so maybe Anton just could zero in on this. So this is just six slides here. So this is the standard customer buying process or cycle for B2B brands generally, which is awareness, consideration, conversion, loyalty, advocacy. So that's quite a common way of describing the process that people go through when discovering a brand, right through to actually purchasing and then becoming an advocate for that brand. Right. So that's a relatively common way to look at it. And let me just click
on here.
For
people listening, that's an upside down triangle with advocacy right at the bottom with a very small percentage and a very large percentage at the top with awareness.
So one thing that I started to work on a few months ago, but I haven't really got that far on, is I started to build a marketing model that I call the pump and funnel marketing model.
Pump and funnel. It sounds like a pub.
There we go. My kind of marketing model. So you know, I turned it into this. We've got this this funnel, this three-stage funnel, which is awareness at the top, consideration, and then conversion at the bottom. Mm-hmm. I've got the river of loyalty underneath when someone becomes a customer after they convert, and then the pump is the advocacy stage, where some of these customers are going to love you so much and want to shout out about you and turn into advocates for your brand.
Right. Ooh, so that's, I absolutely love this. I mean, the illustration might perhaps be more friendly. What we're looking at is a funnel, as you said, with awareness at the top, consideration, conversion, with a loyalty river, which sounds like Harry Potter, and then a pump that pumps the advocates back into the top of the funnel to help make other people aware. And that, for me, honestly, David, makes loads more sense than the
I haven't finished yet.
Oh, sorry, but you're already convincing me. I'm on your side.
So you've heard of I'm sure, and many people listening, watching will have heard of Hero Hub Help. It was originally a YouTube content model. So it's a model Google produced to train people on how to produce videos for YouTube. Hero, big, splashy, incredible content, hub content, episodic content, help content, answering specific questions. And I always thought, when I used to do digital marketing training, that content was at the center of every single digital marketing activity. Mm-hmm. So Even if you're talking about pay-per-click advertising, for example, you've got to have great content, yeah, great copy, great call to action, great landing page. So I think the content is the heart of everything. So I like having content at the heart of a marketing model as well, because it helps people visualize where the different marketing activities fit in and how everything fits together. So those are the three main types of content that Google/YouTube identified for content for YouTube. And there aren't many content marketing models out there, but you know, I thought that was a good starting point, but I didn't think that was everything. So in general, hero content maps to awareness, such as your big, splashy, incredible pieces of content. So that's things like books, virtual summits, short films, higher cost content in general. Help content is good for social media, reviews, blog posts as well. I'm a big fan of Marcus Sheridan's book, They Ask You Answer. That's a great source of what kind of questions you should be answering. And obviously, SEOs know exactly where to be finding out those kinds of questions or keywords as well. And then, interestingly enough, I think that a YouTube channel, a podcast, a course, is the type of content that doesn't fit directly into the funnel. So what happens in B2B, which is the example that I tend to focus in on, is people will discover you to begin with. They might not be ready to purchase, and then they'll forget about you, or they'll go out of your regular purchase funnel. But then they'll maybe discover your podcast channel, your podcast series, or your course, your YouTube channel. And then that will help to build your authority in their mind. And then they'll gravitate back to your brand, your content, and perhaps ask other questions and come back to the consideration phase after that. So I think that's good top of funnel and the middle stage of funnel type content.
Because the illustration is actually that the hub stuff is sitting outside the funnel, feeding both of the awareness and the consideration in this little diagram. Sorry, David.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. But I don't think that's enough content. So I did three other types of content.
You just can't stop, can you? Developing this theory is brilliant.
It's like you with knowledge panels, isn't it?
Yeah, no, exactly. It's terrible, isn't it, David? But this is wonderful.
So I added three other types of content to it that I called heart, happy, and human. It had to be H's, of course, as well.
Yes.
So where do they fit in? Well,
heart
content is the heart of what your business does, i.e. product pages, sales pages, something that describes specifically what you offer and is likely to convert that viewer, that website visitor, into purchasing from you. Happy content, like decent welcome packages, product training, you know, something to make someone happy that they actually made a purchase from you and keep them remembering your brand. And then human content, actually really reaching out to people, giving them personal gifts, appreciation, making them satisfied that they became a customer, and then hopefully turning them into an advocate afterwards. So that is everything. That's all that I've put together so far, and it's quite a lot to it. And I've obviously got to take a bit more time to think about it more and visualize
it
better.
I get the idea. This is the kind of thing that when you started thinking about it, it probably woke you up at 3 o'clock in the morning quite frequently, as you thought, "Ooh, happy," and "Ooh." Heart was the other one, wasn't it? And human.
Theosaurus. What's another H word for this? Yes.
but the diagram you showed, I mean, anybody who's listening on audio only, come and watch the YouTube channel just to get that screen, which is going to be at 32 minutes, I think we're at. And what's wonderful about that is we're currently at CaliCube. We're working on that whole process. Katrina from CaliCube is going to be working on our plan for the next 6 months. So that's going to be perfect for us. So that's amazing. What kind of pushed you to do that? Because, I mean, you were looking at that pyramid and everyone just kind of stops there. Why did you want to go further other than the fact that
I was thinking
curious
about the kind of content that I should be producing for the business that I'm in? So I've obviously produced podcasts and video shows for B2B brands. So then I'm thinking, okay, what kind of content do I need to produce to attract the kind of audience that I want to attract? So I'm halfway down the thought process of maybe creating some kind of B2B marketing summit with this model at the center of it, and getting experts in different areas, but having this model as a thread throughout it, and then sponsored by my particular brand, because majority of viewers, participants would obviously be potentially interested in my products or services. So that's why I was thinking about it. But then I've got quite a bit of work on. I'm thinking nowadays of actually doing something a little bit more specific. So rather than actually jump straight into that, I'm thinking of producing a piece of content that is more, even more targeted. So now what I've got in mind is I'm at the very initial stages of developing a course called Podcast Presentation Skills. So I've got the domain name podcastpresentationskills.com. And what I've done is I've forwarded that to a survey. So I'm just asking people three questions about whether or not they would, or what skills they would actually want to learn in that type of course. So that's a good way of involving your audience as well. So that's the content piece that I'm intending to produce next, and it's obviously going to fit in the hub side of things. But I think it's potentially quite good because it could be appealing to more than just people that want to start a podcast, actually people that just want to be guests on podcasts as well.
Right. I mean, one thing that struck me about the kind of funnel thing that you were showing was the hub is sitting outside of it. So a lot of people would say, well, I won't bother with it then. Can you go through kind of the logic? Because the idea, people think, well, if they're not in my funnel, I'm not interested anymore. But you're saying entertain or keep people engaged even if they're not ready now.
Yeah, I think that's one of the reasons that I focus on podcasts for B2B brands again, because I think that it might not necessarily be the right medium for B2C if you're looking to drive people through your funnel as quickly as possible, i.e. straight away or within a day or so, then it's possibly not right for you. But right. If your sales cycle is long, if your sales cycle is a year plus long, then people aren't going to remember you unless you reach out to them on this word again, medium that they happen to be happier to sit on. So if they prefer YouTube or Facebook or LinkedIn or whatever, then that's a wonderful place to be publishing snippets or full episodes of your video series or audio series. And then they'll experience you again, they'll experience your brand again, and they'll remember, yeah, I was on that site 6 months ago, actually. Might be more relevant for me now. I'm going to go back for it. So it's a way of reaching out to people who've touched your brand in the past but not purchased.
Right. Actually, something occurred to me when I was looking at your diagram as well, is that instead of having the hub just kind of floating outside, you could have it as a cloud above. And that when people get into the awareness, but they don't go down, they evaporate into the cloud, they sit in the cloud, and then at some point it rains back down in your funnel. How does that sound?
That could be a wonderful way to do it. Or the thing is, I think hub content is also great for improving advocacy, making existing customers happier as well.
Right.
So if you look at the model, I'll just put it up again for a second. So you've got the YouTube channel, the podcast course, the hub content, linking to Happy Heart, Help and Hero. So it's linking to all those right. other H's. So yeah,
that's where my theory falls through, obviously, is that
yeah, that was a nice way of saying that. Yeah.
it hooks into all the parts of the funnel, and I had completely missed that.
Thanks. Look, obviously it's a theory at the moment, and I'm open to feedback.
I'm not trying to tell you how to design your delightful drawing and your theory, but sorry, what it's actually brought home to me is the part that I'd missed the first time, is that the hub content is potentially the most important since it feeds into all of the parts.
Yeah, I mean, it could be even where people discover you as well, and then they go to your hero content after that. Generally, people discover your hero content first if you do a good job of that.
All right.
But your hub content, your episodic content, is a wonderful way of just driving people slowly down the funnel without them being aware that they're slipping further down your funnel.
Oh, missus. And you now realise you're part of the CaliCube hub content.
I am indeed, and enhanced by the process. Yes.
Wonderful. Okay. So kind of from your perspective, you're saying, I mean, you said earlier on, a digital marketing strategy is all about content. And content.
I say content is the center point for your digital marketing strategy. So other forms of so all the different forms of digital marketing link into the content and link into different stages of your marketing funnel. So if you have, you know, retargeting, for example, that can fit back into your consideration and conversion phases. So, but you don't link from retargeting to consideration and conversion, because that's not what customers do. What customers do is they link from retargeting into help and heart content. And if you think about it like that, then you're thinking about it more from the customer perspective, the content perspective, instead of the funnel perspective.
What I found, 100%, that makes total sense. And what I found is a lot of the clients I've worked with in the past, at least, focus so much on that kind of bottom of funnel conversion stuff. They don't actually create the content for the help and the hero, and certainly not the hub. And that's a total mistake. I mean, I actually find it difficult working with companies that do that, because you don't have anything to get a grip on. You're always trying to convert right off the bat, and that.
That's where you need your analytics, isn't it? To dive into how long does it take before someone becomes a customer? How many touch points? And how many people are you missing out on because you're not giving them an opportunity to re-engage with you if they're not ready to buy?
Can you use analytics then to analyze kind of where people are kind of, well, not obviously individual people, but where the holes are in your content? Have you got a way to divide your analytics into all those different chunks?
I'm probably more of a fan of simply talking to customers and getting a feel for, you know, where do they come from, what do they prefer to resonate with, and then going through content opportunities myself manually, using wonderful tools like Google Suggest or Answer the Public to identify, you know, specific content or question answering opportunities for the consideration phase, and then maybe brainstorming myself opportunities for the awareness phase based upon what other competitors are doing and answer and gaps in the marketplace as well.
Brilliant. So a human approach. And I mean, that seems to me to be your entire approach from the beginning of this conversation right to the end. Thank you very much, David. That was absolutely awesome. I've learnt loads, and I'm terribly glad we had you on right now, because this is exactly the advice CaliCube needed. So
wonderful.
Thank you, David. Thank you for everybody for watching. I'm just going to announce next week. Next week, it's going to be Mike King. And if we can show that screen, it's going to be, there you go, the value of content engineering, whatever that might possibly mean. But Mike's going to explain it. He's delightful and, as you can see, incredibly cheerful, incredibly smart. And this, I'm looking forward to it, because I really want to know what content engineering is and what's its real value. David, can you pass the baton, please?
I can indeed. And I've been privileged to be able to interview Mike on probably three or four different occasions. Ooh. And he's so engaging, he's so intelligent about highly technical areas of SEO, but he's also creative and funny, and he's a great musician as well. So I look forward to seeing his duet with you, Jason.
Uh-oh. Right. Yeah, you did the answer response thing with your little song, which was absolutely delightful. And I would love to sing a duet with Mike, but I suspect he's just going to rap right back at me after I sing my silly song. Thanks a lot, David. A quick goodbye to end the show. Thank you, David. See you later, man.